ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, welcome to the Best of the Minefield from 2025, now coming at you in 2026. Waleed Ali is my name, Scott Stephens is my co-host. And Scott, we have the best of because we like to make ourselves look good, I think, mostly. And that's connected to the topic today.
It really is. And I think this show was one of the best examples of what it is we try to do on the minefield. We took a relatively antiquated, unusual, somewhat rarefied topic and then traced its various threads through geopolitics, through the moral life, through the moral demands that are upon us. It was a really provocative show. It's on Saving Face. We hope you enjoy it.
It would be fair to say that over the past, well, I'm going to say 3 years, the minefield, and probably longer actually, the minefield has been preoccupied with questions of persuasion. Mm. And deliberation. I was going to say dialogue, but that's not quite right. No, I was going to say discourse. That's not quite right.
No, it isn't. We got the right word right.
Yeah.
Good.
Civil exchange.
Yep.
Things of that nature. At the same time as that, we have seen a series of events in domestic politics, in international affairs and so on, where you might say something akin to brinkmanship has occurred. Mm. That could be situations like Israel's invasion of Iran and the United States' response to that, the dropping of a bunker-busting bomb and declaration that that should end it, and at least in the short term in that particular case it did. A lot of discourse surrounding that sort of thing. We've seen increasingly febrile debates or an increasingly febrile environment around a whole series of debates actually in Australia. The obvious one is to do with Gaza, but actually there are so many more. You could have thrown The Voice in there. Probably wouldn't throw our election in there, which was an interesting counterpoint. But you get the picture. A lot of this sort of stuff is happening. And given our preoccupation with questions of persuasion, one thing that has kept coming up and that we've kind of kept skirting is this idea of providing some kind of space or some set of conditions for people not to persuade only, but to be persuaded. That is, that persuasion can only happen when we create certain environments and approach them with certain virtues that facilitate a kind of exchange where there is an openness going on, but also where the possibility of being persuaded rather than merely being humiliated is there. Mm. And so rather than pin this to any particular event, I've sort of laid that broad description as the context because I think it's important to do so in order to suggest that what we're going to talk about today is a really quite broad application.
Yeah.
From the most heightened and high level controversies to actually the most quotidian. And that's partly, I think, why it's so important. You know, every now and again, you come across one of these things that looks like or feels like a principle that is universal or universalizable, at least. This feels like one of those to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm not sure it is.
Oh, okay. Go on.
I mean, it is worth pointing out, just right off the back of what you've said, that most of the contests, political, social, moral, that we wrestle with, what is being aimed at is victory, the victory of one side, and that's where I think you're absolutely right to exempt Australia's most recent federal election from this particular mix. Most of these contexts tend to be zero-sum in the sense that there is a victor and there is a loser. But I think it's worth pointing out that even in political, moral debates, what we really want is not so much persuasion as we want victory. we want triumph. And what we want from somebody else is not so much being persuaded. What we want is probably something a little bit closer to conversion.
Submission.
We want submission. In other words, we want them to reach a point where not only do they see the error of their ways, but then something happens whereby they name the error of their ways. They recant on those former ways, and they sign up to something that looks a lot more like our side. I mean, really, that's not what persuasion most often looks like. I mean, what usually happens is that two people that have just enough in common, it may well be something, a kind of constitutive shared commitment, say to the principle of common humanity, or the belief that innocent civilians should not be killed, or the idea that a war of aggression is almost always wrong ab initio. So something from the basis of which we have the ability to stay together, even if we disagree on virtually every other point. And then what usually happens is that two people remain together long enough that even if the headline issues about which they disagree do not fundamentally change, we keep circulating back to the same issues, the same impasse, the same disagreement. I might add a qualification where you might want to be a bit more absolutist. I might be a bit more absolutist. You want to insist on a qualification. Those things might be going on in the headline issues at the overt level of discourse itself. But then what's going on underneath is a whole lot of subtle accommodations to the other person's position. You may well find that one person's vocabulary begins infecting the other person's form of argumentation. You may well find that certain issues that were really hot issues of disagreement slowly but surely kind of trickle over to the side. Nobody really renounces them. They just become, for one reason or another, irrelevant. So one of the gifts, I think, that we give people who are involved in positions, in situations of genuine deliberation, dialogue, persuasion, one of the gifts that we give people is we free them from having to recant. We free them from the obligation to be defeated in the argument. We free them from the need to, quote unquote, convert to our side. Now, there are various ways that I think that act of concession can take. Sometimes it can be we just allow the conversation to keep going. No one acknowledges that there was a winner or a loser. I think one of the wonderful things, Waleed, about democratic or broadly moral conversation, here's this for a word, I don't think I've ever used it on the show before. These conversations are autotelic. The end of the conversation, the goal of the conversation is inherent to the conversation itself. There's no outcome that's being pursued. If there is a specific outcome that's being pursued, that it's not genuine conversation. What it is evangelization. What it is a proselytism. There's an act of kind of overt conversion or attempted conversion that's going on. Instead, one of the wonderful things about moral and more broadly democratic conversation is that the goal that is being sought only emerges over the course of the life of the conversation itself. It's almost like the goal exposes itself, reveals itself as the two people who are involved in it, in the conversation, kind of reach a point where they are able to see one another, maybe even see themselves in a way that they didn't before. But then there's another possible outcome, and that might be that one person clearly sees the error of their ways. They clearly see, my God, how could I not have seen that? How could I have proceeded with that particular bias, that bit of wrong information? How is it that I had oriented my life around this particular moral principle, and now I realize it is without foundation, or it's dehumanizing, or it's exclusionary, or it's morally bankrupt, or whatever? And at that moment, now this is where our topic broadens out. At that moment, one of the gifts that we give to the other person is we give them the ability to save face. We give them the ability to preserve their reputation even as they themselves realize that their lives have been caught out in a form of wrongdoing or wrong believing. And what this suggests to me, Waleed, the idea of holding on to the possibility of granting another person the ability to save face, which doesn't just take place in moral conversations. I think we want to broaden this out. But one of the things that this reveals to me is just how addicted we have come to be, socially speaking, to the rites and the spectacles of humiliation. We, in fact, enjoy it when our opponents, when people with whom we profoundly disagree, we enjoy it when they are humiliated, not just because of the schadenfreude that is involved in that spectacle of humiliation, but because when another person is humiliated, our standing de facto goes up in the world.
Yeah, which is why you get these, I see them a lot, even though I don't watch them. It's quite weird how I get served them. But these videos on YouTube of one side of some argument or other, usually political, but doesn't have to be that. Could even be sporting, getting owned or destroyed, so often capital letters, by someone or other.
And then slowed down to sort of a sequence of frames where, and this is the moment their soul broke.
Yeah, all this sort of stuff. Horrible. So this is all combat sport, and we want to see the moment where the knockout punch is laid or whatever. So it's become a bit of a cultural phenomenon. I mean, I think it's always been a human instinct to seek that, right? Because the desire to humiliate one's enemies and thereby puff up one's own pride is a very old instinct. So I suppose the question that falls out of this is, if face-saving is a gift, how far are we prepared to take this? How often should it be given? Is it in fact something that is, in the most generalizable way, a good? Is it something that we should be striving for, not just as a means of effective communication or persuasion, etc.? That is, you'll actually probably win more people over if you give them the opportunity to be won over without humiliating themselves, rather than
what's sometimes called an off-ramp from a bad argument.
Yeah. So if you give them that, then you'll actually be more effective. So there's a kind of pragmatic, self-interested element to it, even if it's enlightened self-interest. But more than that, whether or not it's something actually that we owe each other as human beings, that we allow each other to preserve at all times and to the fullest extent possible the dignity of the human being and the dignity that one has even in being wrong or in changing their mind from wrong to right, whatever it might be. Maybe this is the bit where we differ. I don't know. Do you want to stake out a position and then I can shame and humiliate you for taking it?
I would love to. I actually think this is a really complicated issue. And the reason that I framed it as a gift that we give to somebody else is because I think when it is sought, when I am the person who is trying to save face and I'm doing something in order to save face, I think there are all sorts of dangers that may well pertain to that. Whereas when someone is being given an opportunity to retain a degree of dignity, to retain their sense of self-respect, when they're able to retain a degree of prestige within a larger community, there's something really precious about that. And this, I think, goes back to some of the broader ideas that surround the idea of face itself. I mean, there's a lot of controversy even surrounding the use of a term like saving face in English, because of the extent to which that very term itself has almost certainly been appropriated within Western culture due to its exposure to Chinese culture, Chinese philosophy. So the pairing of saving face and losing face, this was a kind of caricature, if you like, that was often used among Western traders, Western cultural commentators, right back in the 18th and early 19th centuries. But the idea of face as being something like broader social reputation, one's standing within community, something that maybe in the Mediterranean or even in the older cultures of Asia Minor would have been referred to as honor, one's sense of social reputation as something that is given by the society around someone. And when it is taken away, what is lost in the act of having one's honor, one's face taken away, one's reputation ripped away, what's left is, I mean, something like social death. You are dead socially speaking, even if biologically you remain alive. So in honor-shame cultures, to be stripped of honor, to be stripped of the esteem with which members of a community see you is, I mean, certainly in some cultures, a fate worse than death. So the thing about face or the thing about honor is it's not something you can cheat, you can seize, that you can simply achieve. It's something that has to be given to you. And when you then engage in something that is humiliating, when, say, a scandal circulates about you that destroys your reputation, when something has happened whereby you are, let's call it socially speaking, defeated. In other words, somebody else has shown you up, has seized a lion's share of the store of honor or a face that is available. Then you lose accordingly. You drop ranks. So the idea of social standing, of social substance, of social reputation, this is where I think face continues to kind of live and breathe. Geopolitically, I mean, I have to say, one of the things that got us thinking and talking about this was the way that U.S. President Donald Trump extended a kind of face-saving gesture to the Ayatollah Khamenei after the U.S. dropped the bunker-busting bombs on Iran's nuclear facilities. Iran warned the United States that it was going to strike a U.S. base in Qatar, did so in a rather half-hearted way. And Donald Trump effectively said it was a response, it was a weak response, you did what you had to do, let's now move on. That was a face-saving gesture.
Once you articulate it, though.
No, that's right.
It would have been a face-saving gesture had he not said that it was a face. So,
but come on, what are we talking about here?
I know. I don't want to get into the intricacies of.
No, you're right. Trump, of course, you're right.
Yeah, but you can't say, "Well, okay, well done, little kid. You got it out of your system, and it was very weak." And all right, can we just move on? That's not face saving. That's belittling. But if he'd sort of not called out the weakness of the response or all of that, then it would have allowed it to be face-saving. Now, as it turns out, though, it's not a bad example because it was face-saving, at least as far as the Iranian regime was concerned.
Yeah.
Because
we have the ability to strike a U.S. Yes. military facility whenever we want to.
And they've come to heel in response to the overwhelming force of the revolutionary regime, etc. And that was very much the message in Iranian media. So there was that sort of face-saving going on. That does make me think a little bit about the absolutism of face-saving.
Can I just say, this is the other point. Mm. Hannah Arendt, in her extraordinary 1971 essay, Lying in Politics, after she had her first exposure to the Pentagon Papers, one of the things that she was horrified by is she said, you know, the pattern of mendacity, of deception of the American people, this was for the purpose of saving the reputation of the United States. This is over Vietnam, by the way, over the success, the winnability of the conflict in Vietnam, over the advisability, the legitimacy of the United States continuing to pursue that particular military campaign in Vietnam. She said the whole reason for this was to save the reputation of the United States and its president. Now, that, I think, is where face-saving, preserving reputation, even at the expense of cataclysmic loss of life, the determination that any weakness, any drop in my social standing has got to be deflected. It has got to be it's got to be diverted. That's where I think face-saving, ultimately, when it's sought by oneself, is a form of political or social ego-seeking or ego-protection.
Yeah, okay, so I see that point, but I wouldn't blame face-saving for that. I would blame a lack of imagination or a closing off of the options of alternative ways of saving face. So in other words, I think
the United States saying we lost this war, we're pulling out because this is an unwinnable war, that is inconceivable within U.S. political discourse.
Sure, we can talk about the specifics of the example. All I'm saying is the ideal scenario there is that there is a way to save face that doesn't involve killing people for the sake of preserving one's pride.
Sure.
So let's agree on two things. Let's agree on one thing. That to oppress another for the sake of preserving your own pride,
yeah,
that is a thoroughgoing wrong.
Yeah.
We agree on that.
Good.
That's not what I have in mind when I talk about the importance of face-saving. That what face-saving does, especially where it is offered, and that, to be fair, is the way I was conceiving of it. I wasn't conceiving of something else. But
sure,
what face-saving offers is a way of climbing down from one's position. Hmm. And it may well be that someone declines that offer and they move further into a position that becomes intractable and so on and so forth. And it may well be that you reach a point where face saving becomes just impossible. But that's not to say that it wouldn't be preferable in theory.
Hmm.
And I just don't know. I'm not sure I can think of an exception to that, where actually the point is that you don't get to save face, right? The point is that, because even when you think about criminals, people who have committed serious crimes and are convicted, one of the most glorious things about the legal system, I think, is the way in which, via its procedural stuffiness and its quite formulaic language and all of the pomp and ceremony that surrounds the legal profession and the court, one of the things it does is it depersonalizes so much and it allows the preservation of the dignity of the accused and then ultimately the convicted, even as they are being lacerated from the bench.
That's right.
Right. There is something really important in that. That is preserving, I think, a crucial element of civil society as a going concern. And that if you abandon that and you end up adopting what you might actually recognize as a more kind of revolutionary mode of justice or violence, where the point is humiliation, I think you're tipping now over into, you know, we want people personally abused and hung up and strung up, etc. I think you're tipping over into something that is far more dangerous and not preferable in just about any instance.
Can I add just a quick qualification to that, though? So you've got two examples there. One, the relative dignity that is accorded to the accused and the convicted within the legal system versus a more revolutionary form of the dispensing of justice, which may well involve degradation, humiliation, public whipping, public execution, whatever. There is something in between those two that may well take the shape of something like restorative justice, where the accused or the convicted, usually the convicted, are made to hear the experiences of the testimony of those who have borne the consequences of what it is that they have done.
Yeah.
So I think there's an interesting wrinkle here. Take the conclusion of what I think is one of the greatest novels of all time, E.M. Forster's Howards End, where Henry Wilcox, who is a duplicitous but extremely proud, socially upright man who wants to preserve social reputation at all costs, even though he himself has been involved in various forms of socially and morally deplorable action. At one point, towards the end of the novel, he engages in a form of hypocrisy that his wife, Margaret Schlegel, concerning Margaret Schlegel's sister, Helen, that she can no longer, I mean, you know, they've been married for a long time. She's been putting up with his duplicity, with his pride, with his arrogance for a long time, but there reaches a point where his concern for his social reputation is such that he cannot realize, he cannot see the extent to which he is condemned by his own hypocrisy. And she says to him at one point, just say these words, what Helen has done, I have done. In other words, what she's asking for him to do there is not just to mouth something, but rather to sacrifice his own sense of his own social respectability. And his refusal to do that is the thing that keeps his social ego locked in a kind of self-protective but ultimately duplicitous fortress. And it's that that it almost functions like a moral cancer on his own soul. There is no moral improvement for Henry Wilcox unless he is able to acknowledge that he has already degraded his own social reputation. That, I think, is getting really close to what goes on with restorative justice, where, yes, the proper dignity has been accorded, but there has to be a blow to the, I hate using this term, to the agential ego, to the ego that was responsible for these crimes, to the malignant ego that did these things to these people. There has to be a blow in order for there to be a resumption of this person's place within moral community, even if it's under the sign of justice, incarceration, and so on. I think this is where simply presuming that someone ought to be allowed to preserve face as a way of defending or protecting their own sense of themselves. There are ways that that itself can go, I think, badly wrong, can keep a degree of ego malignancy that's ultimately detrimental to they themselves.
Only if it's the organizing principle around which everything else revolves.
Yeah, right? That's true. That's
so
true.
It remains the case that if there were some face-saving way for him to realize his wrong and to make amends and even to reform himself, that would be preferable. What you're describing there is a scenario where that has been offered and rejected and offered and rejected and offered and rejected. And it reaches a point of crisis where the offer is impossible now. Now you're talking about a different situation, but it's the lesser pathway. If I could construct an alternative scenario where you or he, in this case, were able to come to the full realization but save face in the process, you would choose that. And I would argue you should choose that.
Mm-hmm.
And the altering or the reformation of the ego, I mean, I suppose shame and humiliation can be a way to do that, but I'm not convinced.
Yeah, that's
actually.
Right. That's right.
I think if you're talking about someone who has a monstrous ego, not allowing them to save face and seeking their humiliation is likely only to make them dig in harder.
Can I ask you a question on that point?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be worthwhile drawing an important distinction? If we have on the one hand a kind of self-enclosed ego, someone, I realize this is a strange term to use, but I'm going to use it anyway, someone who is locked in a condition of self-deception. They don't realize just how large their ego looms, not so much in their own life, but in the lives of the people around them. As a result, they live in a condition of self-deception where they simply do not realize the effect that their lives are having on the people around. Could you say that what might be experienced by them as humiliation, we would probably more properly describe coming to a certain amount of self-knowledge?
That's possible.
Yep. So if the telos, if the goal is humiliation as humiliation, I want to see this person groveling, weeping. I think you're right. I mean, only a sadist would actually want that. But it may well be that arriving at a point of self-knowledge where one really can be a moral member of a community as well as a social member of that community, that may well be experienced. I mean, one of the things, Walid, I'll never forget discovering through some really brave people who showed it to me, is two of the points of the year where domestic violence peaks is during grand final week and during the Christmas holidays.
Mm.
Because so many men are feeling degraded, humiliated, incapable of providing for their family, resentful to their wives, resentful to their children. They are so invested then in reasserting ego, reasserting control, that then explodes in various forms of ego defense, almost as face-saving. The recognition of this is what your life is doing to the lives of those around you. I mean, that may well be experienced as itself a form of emasculation, whereas really it should be a form of moral liberation.
You are listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Around this time, we seek the help of a guest, and boy, do we need it. Scott.
As someone who does not eat meat, I'm using this phrase advisedly, we've left a whole lot of philosophical meat on this particular bone. So we really needed a great philosopher to help us tease this out. And who better than Karen Jones? She's Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Melbourne, a great friend of the Mindfield. Karen, welcome back.
Thanks very much for having me. What I think I want to start by contributing is a few thoughts that might actually offer some support to Waleed's perspective, because face saving can be part of a whole way of approaching ethics that's actually about ego taming, not ego protecting. Mm. And here I want to actually, because I think it'll be really fruitful, draw back to some of the Chinese sources from which we get the actual term in English. And you're right, there are echoes under honor codes and cultures elsewhere, but there's something really distinctive in the Chinese tradition. And if we overlook it, I think we misunderstand just how important face saving can be. And to loop back to what what Waleed Ali said about the ethics of argumentation, how it can play a role in here. Because we can think face-saving is just about this kind of ego protection. But actually, for the Chinese, it's deeply embedded in a communal ethic. And it's deeply connected to this other notion called Li, which is sometimes translated as ritual, and it definitely includes ritual, but it also includes etiquette and it includes manners. And it is a everyday ethics in which every single interaction you have with another person, right, is part of creating a potential seamless flow in which we all respect each other so we can take our egocentric, selfish, just, or even just going about our own business selves, and we can manage to interact respectfully while doing something as trivial as lining up for a cup of coffee, or we can fail to do that. And I have just recently witnessed some spectacular acts of rudeness in the coffee queue, right? So it's an everyday ethics that should permeate every single aspect of our life. And when somebody makes a faux pas, according to these like rules of Li, right, there is a potential for embarrassment. And what we should do if we want to create the seamless shared public life where our ethics is permeating every single thing we do, everything we say, is we should support and help that person, right? We shouldn't argue our point relentlessly, because why are we doing this? Why are we seeking to embarrass that person? Instead, we should perhaps offer a quiet correction, or let a point slide where it doesn't matter if we have to make it. And so to me, once you bring in this idea of the centrality of a deeply social ethics, so we're not talking about individualism, we're not talking about autonomy here, we're talking about a deeply social ethics in which all of us have undergone a process of ego taming to be fit participants for this fundamentally social enterprise, then you can see why it matters so much that we allow each other to save face. And we do this through our rules of etiquette, manners, and we can, though actually it's not so much brought about in the traditional Chinese texts, we can move this from how we should interact with our superiors, Confucius himself was very hierarchical, to talking about the ethics of argumentation, where I don't mean are we actually drawing on false premises or so on, but the kinds of things you were worried about, if we badger, if we bully, if we gloat, like how our ethics of argumentation has gone so very wrong. And one reason it has is a deep failure of manners. But don't think of this as something trivial, because they're the glue, according to the Confucian tradition, that creates us as an us and makes space for sociality, recognizing difference and recognizing individual failure.
And refracted that way, the refusal of offering face-saving becomes itself an act of ego.
That's right.
Because what's happening there is the desire to assert dominance, the desire to receive submission and to deny that person their social right, really, to be a fully dignified member of a society that they're functioning in.
Yeah. And that's why I think this does sort of support some of your pro allowing people to be able to save face. And what it also does is potentially push some people out of this shared enterprise altogether. And embarrassment can do that momentarily. But if it goes through to shame, and some of this desire to like conquer and defeat your opponent actually is a desire not just to humiliate them, it's to make them feel deep shame, right? And shame is corrosive, because unlike something like guilt or unlike embarrassment, though embarrassment is really not good and it does break this fluid social dance that the Confucian ethics sort of highlights, but shame, it attaches to your whole self, so not just to an aspect of yourself. And philosophical analyses of it, but also just think about your own experience of shame. I'm assuming you've had one, we all have, unless we're like psychopaths. It prompts withdrawal. So if you shame someone, you're effectively inviting them, well, you're pushing them out. And if they feel shame in response to this, they will want to withdraw, because hiding yourself, hiding your face is part of what it is to experience shame. And if you hide your face, you can no longer contribute to this like shared enterprise. And that can be toxic.
So I feel a tension here because at the same time as all of that is offered in support of a position I was articulating, I do think, and we've done a show on this previously, so I won't preach too much, I do think there is something to be said for shame in that the absence or the opposite of it is shamelessness. And that strikes me as hugely corrosive. So it seems to me that shame well placed is important. I can see the way in which, particularly if it's invoked upon the self in relation to a particular thing, not as an irredeemable trait, but as something that can then be the spur for some kind of improvement or moral reformation or whatever, then I can see its usefulness. I hesitate to use the example of parent and child because there are clearly examples where shame in that context is hugely detrimental. But at the same time, I suspect there would be very few parents who wouldn't admit that it's a very useful lever to pull if it's pulled in exactly the right way, at exactly the right time, to exactly the right extent. And as I listen to you describe this sort of face-saving arrangement, if we call that, or let's call it an ethic in society, the question that pops up, which is in some ways related to the shame question, is can you have that without having what becomes a quite dishonest society? That is one that is incapable of speaking frankly to each other, even honestly to each other, about matters of very serious concern. Does deference have to overcome even the demands of justice, for example?
I think there's two thoughts in there. One about shame, and definitely being shameless will put you beyond the possibility of moral education. Mm. And there are a few people in this world who are shameless, and they are
not improvable.
Yeah. And if they have any power, we won't mention names, they are like danger globally. And so both Confucius and Aristotle said the potential, the capacity for shame is absolutely crucial.
Yep. Right?
And we won't get to be good without it. So it can keep us on the rails of striving to get to be virtuous. When we are actually virtuous, we shouldn't be feeling shame because we should not be doing the wrong kinds of things such that other people's shaming would be worthwhile. So will this view mean we can't have robust conversations? You know, there is, I think, a Western view that people who are of Chinese heritage are far too oblique. And could we please just cut to the chase?
Yeah.
Here's my point. Just say my point, right? Maybe that's true, though I'm always very cautious of you know, sweeping generalizations, but there's
And
just...
I don't mean to interrogate Chinese culture in doing this, by
no.
the way. I'm speaking more
yeah.
actually applicable in our context.
Yeah. It is. So we do want some moves where we can engage in kind of robust discussion, right? But I think we tend to confuse robustness with rudeness and with dogmatism. Mm.
Yep.
Philosophers are guilty of this. Not that I myself have ever done it in the past year.
Right,
I'll just save my face here. You know, obviously I've done it. It can be built into the norms for conversation, but fundamentally, Lee, is about norms for how you interact with others. And you can have norms for interacting with others that allow robust conversation, but don't allow cheap shots, belittling, demeaning, refusing to listen.
Yeah.
So I think if you had this idea of li, the li of argumentation, the manners, the etiquette of argumentation, and we trained ourselves up in that a little bit more, we might start to do better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That voice, by the way, belongs to Karen Jones, if you've just joined us, as Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Melbourne. You are listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host, who is sitting there like a coiled spring. Scott.
Oh, no, this is glorious. I mean, I just have to say, one of the things that immediately comes to mind is, I mean, as a great Jane Austen fan, the whole regime of manners that the characters of her novels inhabit. Those manners do two things. They mediate the possibility of social commerce, of exchange, of human interaction. They also prevent people from ever really saying to one another what it is they really mean, which is why one of the things that makes Jane Austen's novels both wonderful and infuriating is that the characters are revealing just as much as they are concealing until you reach those moments where one character bears their soul to another. And then you find the various forms of social pretense dropped. But the thing that makes those forms of moral encounter possible is the regime of manners that holds them together in the first place. Here's the question I wanted to put to you, though, Karen. It seems to me, please correct me if I'm wrong, there is a stark difference between Li, as you've just described it, which is something more like the environment within which social interaction takes place. If you fall out, there are then ways back in. Within the, say, Mediterranean cultures of honor-shame, or even more broadly, the honor-shame cultures of Asia Minor, honor is a limited commodity, and it really is a limited social commodity. When one person loses some, loses standing, loses social reputation, it usually is of men, that is laying there on the ground ready for someone else to pick up and to accept, to take of their own. That idea that there is only so much face to go around, and so there's a kind of social or even political interest in some people losing theirs. We want to see people humiliated. I mean, this is the perverse incentive that Immanuel Kant recognized, that there is a kind of social interest. It's an immoral interest, but there's a kind of social interest in the spreading of calumny, in the spreading of scandalous information, even if it's true about a prominent figure, because once they are decreased, we are, illegitimately, but nonetheless affectively, we are increased. So what you're holding out doesn't have any of the elements of competition or the idea of kind of a zero-sum contest, which still flows very much, it seems to me, through our politics and through our broader cultural economy.
It does. That's why I wanted to distinguish this notion of etiquette, manners, Li, and the commitment to a robust sociality that I think is at the heart of Confucian ethics from a mere honor code stuff, because honor code's zero sum.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, what is true in those Confucian texts, and not surprising, and continues to this day, is exactly how those rules of manners, etiquette, and so on are supposed to work embed social hierarchy. So it is a way of seamlessly and without violence through a kind of microeconomics of power, a way in which we can reproduce bad social relations.
Hence the critique that civility is a way of oppressing people whose voices are marginalized, etc.
Absolutely, and I've got a lot of sympathy with that critique. But it isn't intrinsic to the few that the norms that govern it are norms that will reproduce and maintain hierarchy. What's at the core of this kind of view is an ethics of the everyday, a way of seeing how it is that even our micro interactions could embed respect for others so that we are able smoothly and without banging into each other, literally and figuratively, or at least not very often, able to negotiate our sociality and become, this is Amy Olberding, she's writes about Confucian ethics and has just had like an enormous influence on me, talks about a kind of dance, a way in which we can make ourselves attractive to be with, which will end the kind of tendency towards misanthropy that, you know, Kant was worried about, that if we get up too close and personal, everybody will see our nasty egos, our petty desires. It's like, who'd want to hang out with that person where I'm including myself in those persons, right? So we have this way of being able to present ourselves collectively, and it isn't a zero-sum game. But some of the rules, of course, could make rules that reinforce relations of hierarchy, but the ethical framework itself is separate from claims about what the right forms of etiquette, what the right forms of manners would
be. Yeah, I mean, I'm less persuaded by the critique on the basis of reinforcing oppressive structures, only because the desire to violate those structures in pursuit of some kind of equalization or whatever tends to have the consequence of that violation then being repurposed against you by those who already have the power to do so.
That's right.
And so it doesn't achieve anything, A, and B, it tends to leave behind a bit of a wasteland. So that's just in some why I'm skeptical of that sort of thing. But as you talk about it, and even hearing Scott's intervention before, the question, and I think it's quite an urgent one actually, that this raises for me is, are democracies capable of face-saving? Because once you factor in that democracy is a win-lose proposition, certainly at election time. I mean, it's not necessarily in between times, but it is at election time. And once you factor in that the humiliation or the embarrassment of one's opponent tends, especially in a two-party system, to lead to a corresponding bump in your own fortunes. And you add to that the fact that political parties' reason for being is to win elections.
It is an honour-shame culture, isn't it? I mean, it really is.
I just wonder, can you conceive realistically, or even theoretically, but let's make it realistic, can you realistically conceive of a way that democracy would be able to escape that honour-shame dynamic?
You know, one thing I think that's important, we don't have the one election that is to be the election that resolves things forevermore.
Of course. Yeah,
and actually, I think that really matters for how a party that loses and supporters of that party feel about their capacity to go on and go on collectively with the party that won.
Yes.
And when you're seeing the kind of polarization you're seeing in the US, which is actually fracturing families, people won't talk across political divides, even who were previously friends. It's busting apart friendships. And there is a kind of winner takes all, and we have won now and forever, and you guys are evil. That is very much part of the MAGA discourse. And if you've got that, you're definitely in zero-sum game. But if you have got the sense that we're not going to cook the electorates, there is another election coming, here's what we're working with now, how can I influence, as you can, of course, as a member of parliament, the policies and so on that'll go on, and then how can I present a case, and I might win next time. And I think that matters hugely
but
for the possibility.
More, I'm thinking more of the situation. All right, I've won an election, I'm in government. Yeah. I know the more embarrassment and humiliation I can pour on those guys who've just lost, the more likely it is that I'll retain this job.
You know, I don't think that's true.
Okay.
But there's a danger it could become true. When you talk to people about political point scoring and the amount of just bully boy posturing and that goes on in Parliament, it turns people off.
Yeah.
So I don't actually think you will win the next round by how vigorously you can humiliate your opponent. I think you'll win the next round by how much you can actually offer to the people who voted for you before, and especially to the people
Karen,
who didn't.
This is very
optimistic.
This is
very naive. But anyway, I think the bully boy stuff doesn't help. People just recognise that as rudeness. It turns people off. I can't stand to watch
negative election campaign ads work.
True.
Yeah, that's true.
But hang on. But then there's the spectacle. And I mean spectacle as in something that is kind of immediately arresting and visible, of bipartisan, mutually sponsored bills over a shared object of concern or in order to protect a common object of love. There are things about that that I think are necessarily elevating. But hang on. I have a question for you both. I just want to move things a little bit away from politics, although not completely away from politics. So we've talked about the kind of human impulse to humiliate. And Karen, I think you're exactly right. One of the problems with shame in honor-shame cultures is that shame tends to have a taint that sticks. Once you've lost honor, it's very, very, very difficult without bloodshed to get that back. I mean, if you want to know what that looks like, if you want to know how honor and shame maps precisely onto who is the most manly man, then just read Homer's Iliad. I mean, that's precisely, it's the contest of honor, shame, who gets to boast being the most full of honor man of all. Let's talk about those people who already have been disgraced. Those people who already have been shamed, not wrongfully accused, but perhaps rightly accused, and yet have had all of this material spread about them. They have lost face. I mean, they have lost face. And if we are talking about retrieving something more like face-saving culture rather than simply honor-shame culture, what does it then look like for us to believe, as a democratic society, when it's morally formed and striving after certain forms of shared recognition, of acknowledgement, and of mutual accommodation, What does it then look like to begin the process whereby the first line of a story written about someone isn't their past calumny, isn't their past disgrace? What does it mean, in other words, to enable those who have already lost face to begin gaining a degree of it back? Because what it looks like to me at the moment is what Vladimir Jankélévitch calls calendrical forgiveness. We just hope that the ticking over of the clock, the passing of the months, does enough to redeem the person we all end up forgetting.
That's not nothing, by the way.
That's not nothing, but I also don't think it's enough.
Yeah, well, that's fair. But that's why, and I'll give the last word to you, Karen, but that's why, although everything I said about the law and certain forms of punishment and so on before, I meant, but I say it lightly, because I think it's possible, for example, for shame or humiliation or whatever to be a feature of punishment. In some ways, the fact that you went to prison is humiliating, is shaming, whatever. But it can only work, I think, where it becomes redemptive. So in that case, what's happened is it is not a judgment of you all the way down to the depths of your soul.
The humiliation can be left behind.
It is something that the debt is paid at some point. We use that sort of phrasing, right? Whatever form the punishment takes, you come out the other side and we now move on together. That's at least the theory. We may not do it. There's all sorts of stuff that can happen around it, but that's at least the idea. And so I am more comfortable with that sort of social arrangement where we recognize that shame or humiliation or the loss of face or whatever may attach to your behavior in a particular moment and the consequences that flow from it naturally and perhaps even unavoidably, but that they cannot be permanent and they cannot be a way of forming a judgment of bad being. They can be a judgment of bad doing, but that's as far as it can go. And if we understand it that way, then the possibilities for redemption or whatever that's not merely calendrical, I think, open up. Karen?
This is a difficult and interesting question, you know, and here's a horrible thing that happened historically. So I've been defending classical Chinese philosophy. They had five punishments anyway, and two of them were tattooing your face and cutting off your nose. Mm. And if this has happened to you, you are forever marked. And that, of course, was precisely the point. Mm. So it would make any kind of redemption impossible. And we worry in these days of social media that redemption's impossible because the calendar ticks over, but the facts just remain there to be Googled, you know, at any point.
It can be retweeted at any moment.
At any point. Yeah. So what is it that we do, metaphorically speaking, that amounts to tattooing someone's face and cutting off their nose? And there is a lot of small acts that perhaps partake of that, you know, constant return to the fault committed when there has been apology, when there has been some kind of moving on.
Or punishment.
Or punishment. And by the way, some social media reforms, people being able to take stuff down, a kind of right to move on, might actually help here. So that's not a lot to say, but we are sometimes insistent, and it's not a good impulse, on marking those who have behaved badly. Wow. And sometimes we justify this by saying, which is perhaps what was behind these five punishments, if we don't, then that person could return to society as a trusted member and burn other people. And, you know, maybe that can happen if someone's reputation has been rehabilitated before they've been rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. That's actually a risk.
What's the kind of argument that would be very popular now in the case of, say, pedophilia?
It is, and we're seeing it in Queensland.
Well, that's not where I expected that to end, but it is nonetheless where it must. Karen, it's always so great having you.
Thank you very much. It's been fun.
Karen Jones, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Melbourne, our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield. That's it from us this week. You can catch us again next week on ABC Radio National, but of course I should point out, indeed I must point out, you can also catch us anytime you like on the ABC Listen app. So you go do that now, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.